Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Mr. Bonnie, with all the frills upon it, oh, you'll be the grandest lady in the Easter parade.
9:35, Dean Richards, Easter Sunday morning on WGN. Welcoming once again Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern's Central DuPage Hospital. Happy Easter, my friend. How are you?
Dean, I am great. Happy Easter to you. What a beautiful day here.
Could not be a nicer day, and probably speaks well to have a nice day like this with COVID numbers trending upward. At least people will be outside. That's a good thing, right?
Absolutely. I would tell everyone who's going to do any gathering today, push it outside. Take the opportunity to get some natural vitamin D and then also get some circulating air around you and decrease the chance of any spread. So 100%.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what kind of things should people avoid doing today? People are just so anxious to get things back to normal. They probably missed out on a holiday celebration last year, so they really want to try to do something this year. But what shouldn't they do today in their haste to get things back on track?
You know, one thing I would recommend is, you know, you're going to have grandparents and family members that are going to get together and see grandchildren potentially for the first time in a long time. And you're really going to want to go up and give them a big hug and, you know, just spend as much time close to them as possible. And I would just say, hey, we know that the kids aren't vaccinated yet. We aren't sure if an adult who's fully vaccinated can spread that. So let's, you know, take the opportunity to see the kids, but still kind of keep your distance. Do a fun fist bump instead of a hug and a kiss, and try to socially space right now. With the weather the way it is, it should be easy to do outside, and hopefully everyone will get through this holiday without spreading any more.
Yeah, we're so close to the end of this, hopefully, you know, with vaccines and things moving along with that. But people are just so tired of the fist bump, the elbow bump.
Yeah, they are.
I get it. I understand, yeah. But it's just so important that we maintain being careful right now. Even with people that are vaccinated, you're saying, you still should keep your distance, huh?
Well, you know, people that are vaccinated are protected, so we're not concerned about those. Matter of fact, if you have a group of people, if let's say your four people are getting together and they're all vaccinated, take the masks off, sit, have dinner. Our concern now is the potential still, because we aren't 100% sure that a fully vaccinated person can't still spread that to a kid or to an unvaccinated, you know, teenager or, you know, young adult who hasn't had the opportunity to get vaccinated yet.
So it's the people who are not vaccinated, that's where the concern is right now. If you're vaccinated, you're okay, but you still could spread something to someone who is not vaccinated.
Correct. Yeah, when you look at the rates of effectiveness of these vaccines, we are really well protected for those who have been fully vaccinated. Even those who have had one vaccine and are waiting a couple more days before their time comes up for the second vaccine certainly have some great protection as well. So it's helping us really get to a point of, I don't want to say normalcy yet, but certainly with the rates of vaccines that we're seeing, certainly going to be a whole lot different here in a couple of weeks.
Now, how does all this coincide with our concern about variants and that the vaccine, you know, we just don't know, right, whether or not the vaccines are going to be effective against the different variants?
Yeah, the variants that we're seeing right now, the British variant, the vaccines are matching up very good against it. The Brazilian, the South African, those are the ones that are concerns, but in very low numbers right now. So hopefully that won't bump up. But this is one of those, you know, it's like the Kentucky Derby race to the finish. Is the variant going to win or is the vaccine rate going to win? And I'll tell you, it's neck and neck right now.
Dr. Fauci yesterday was interviewed and said there are two key things that we can do to prevent more infections and more hospitalizations and more deaths. Keep getting people vaccinated as quickly as possible, and double down on all the public health measures that have been recommended, continuing with the masks and distancing. I presume that you are in agreement with Dr. Fauci on all of that.
100%. You know, we still have a lot of people, Dean, who feel like, oh, this really isn't a bad illness. I don't think I need the vaccine. I'll tell you, if you read the Chicago Tribune, take the opportunity to read the article on a gentleman named Chris Ward, who, here's a guy who is a father of three young kids, ran marathons, was a hockey coach, very healthy and vibrant, and right before Thanksgiving got COVID. And it just shows the impact of his life, how long he was in the hospital and, you know, his rehab. It's a very uplifting story when you hear what he's gone through. But it's just a reminder to all of us that even if you are healthy and young, this is still a disease that is not necessarily a speed bump. People, the long haulers with headaches and loss of taste and smell and brain fog and fatigue, you know, certainly some people are going to get through with a pretty much asymptomatic. But boy, if I was in Vegas, I certainly wouldn't be betting on that.
Yeah, and it's because of people like that, right, that the positivity rate is climbing up at a time when it should be going down, really, with all the vaccinations, because some people are just refusing to take the recommended precautions.
100%. We're getting more complacent. And then this is where the variants come back into play, because the variants we know are more contagious. They spread easier. And that's simple Darwinism at its easiest. You know, the survival of the fittest, that who can spread faster will survive. So we know that the vaccines work. But those who are unvaccinated and are now getting exposed to this variant are spreading it amongst those unvaccinated at a rate that's a little bit concerning to us.
How long do some of the effects linger after this? I was talking with somebody yesterday who had COVID in November and, you know, didn't need to be hospitalized or anything like that, but it was not pleasant for that person. Among the things that happened to them was losing their taste and smell, which is still not back. Is that normal that it would take this long?
Well, you know, the long haulers, we don't know enough about them. I could tell you Northwestern right now has a clinic for these individuals that are looking at individuals with heart problems, with pulmonary problems, with neurologic problems. So we're really starting to look at other treatment options. You know, when you look at the number of people that have those symptoms, Dean, like your friend, they're kind of scattered. What Northwestern has done is said, let's bring them all together so we can learn from this group to see if a medication works in a more focused effect. Because we don't know yet, you know, anybody who got, you know, COVID in November and hasn't got their taste or smell back, certainly there's some that got it back, you know, 2 weeks, 10 days later. There's others that have gone 6 months, still with headaches, still with brain fog. So fortunately, you know, here in Chicago, we have the opportunity with large academic medical centers to put these individuals together, look for commonalities, and look for potential treatments.
312-981-7200 is our number. Your questions for Dr. Kevin Most. You can call in. I'd love to hear from you. You can text in 312-981-7200. This is the perfect question for Kevin Most. Can you ask about the new variants and anything different that we should do when we're playing golf outside? Is it still okay to play golf outside without masks while maintaining 6 feet distance?
100%. You know, the beauty of being outside and playing golf is you control your environment completely. Whether you're playing with, you know, four guys and four caddies, eight people around a couple acres that you're walking on each time, certainly be really careful. You know, we're not really concerned, again, about touching flags and clubs, but the close proximity. We even tell people, hey, you know, on the greens, just be careful about being spaced. I wouldn't wear a mask. It's not, you know, don't worry about that. But certainly being outside, fresh air, a lot of air circulation and distancing, the golf course is probably the safest place you can be.
Yeah, sometimes you just forget about the distancing, though, don't you? When you're outside, you somehow feel safer out in the fresh air. And, you know, the natural tendency is to sometimes get within the 6 foot space that is recommended. So you just have to kind of keep a special attention to that, right?
100%. You know, I took a walk this morning. I can't tell you how many neighbors I walked by, but they're walking in groups. You know, Mark Twain said, you know, what is golf? Golf is a good walk spoiled. But if you look at golf, you're spreading yourselves out. When people are taking these walks because it's beautiful to be outside, many of them are walking in groups in very close proximity. If they're all from your same pod, that's great. But if it's a neighbor or someone else that you really don't know a lot about, I would say be really careful. And if you want to be outside and walking in close proximity, go ahead and wear a mask. It's the safest thing to do.
Even if it's side by side and you're not likely to expel something by talking or laughing or, you know, something, if they're over on your left or your right, is that you should still have 6 foot spacing that way?
No, you know, I think, you know, really when people walk, they probably have 4 feet between themselves anyways, and they are moving. You know, what I'm concerned about is when two groups come upon each other and they stop and talk.
Yeah.
So if you're moving, you know, that's okay. You're moving and you're 4 feet apart and you're not singing songs, you know, the chance of you spreading the virus is pretty small.
Boy, that's the last time I tell you about what I do when I go on my walk. out singing songs. Dean, can you ask Dr. Most when you can start giving blood again? I've been fully vaccinated as of February.
Yeah, you can start giving blood right now. So if you've been fully vaccinated in February, you are good to go. Individuals that have had COVID, we're still using antibodies, you know, from their serum to treat. Although those numbers have gone down as far as how many we're treating right now, just because our numbers are so much lower. But certainly you can give blood. And I could tell people, please take the opportunity to give blood. We've had blood shortages around the whole country, to be honest with you. And we're really looking at the difficulty of bringing individuals in to get to do blood drives at Northwestern. We do them with hospital-based individuals because it's difficult to get the public in at this time.
Yeah, I know there have been some mobile blood drives, these vans that go around like RVs, where they can do it safely and control the amount of people. Sometimes it's even done outside. But
yep,
there is a great need for that. This is Nancy. You are on with Dr. Kevin Most. Hello.
Well, good morning, and thank you both ever so much for being there for this full year for everyone in the Rockford area.
Thank you.
I just can't say enough. But I also want to ask, the second Moderna, why are we all getting this red, horribly inflamed arm that is just not going away after almost a week?
Yeah, Nancy, and not everybody, but there certainly is the group that's getting that cutaneous, in other words, the superficial portion of the skin is getting irritated. And a lot of people are saying, boy, you know what, I got it in my left arm for the first shot. Knowing that this going on, I'm going to take it in the other arm. Again, our body's immune systems act differently, and it causes an inflammatory response. And inflammation is what? Redness, swelling, tenderness, warmth. Those are all the expectations. It should fade, and if it doesn't, the chance that it's a cellulitis, very low. In other words, they cleaned your skin before that they gave you the shot. But certainly that's a possibility, but extremely rare because of the professionalism of these nurses, and they've been doing so many that they're giving the shots very, very safely.
And how long does it last?
Well, in individuals, some people, I can tell you my redness lasted about 4 days. In other people, it's been lasting up to a couple of weeks. And again,
okay. That's
your immune system saying, hey, I'm turned on,
right,
and I am, you know, really trying to make a good response here.
Okay. And what are the responses that you're finding in the Johnson & Johnson as far as side effects for the people that are going to get that?
Yeah, the Johnson & Johnson, the beauty of it is it's a one shot right now. Might there be a second, a booster in the future? Very possible. But we're seeing about the same effect rate, but milder symptoms because they're not getting that second shot 21 or 28 days later when the immune system has already been turned on and then given that primer and then right on top of that booster. So, people have said, hey, if you had your choice, I got Pfizer. But if people said, if you had your choice, which vaccine would you take right now? And Johnson & Johnson comes to the top of my list for a couple reasons. One, it was tested against the variant, so don't be afraid of the 65% effective rate versus the 95% effective rate. Two, it's a single shot. One and you're done. 20 days later, you have the same coverage as you would if you were going to go through the full vaccine with either Pfizer or Moderna. So I wouldn't wait for it. I'd get whatever shot you can possibly get, but don't be hesitant to take the Johnson & Johnson.
Nancy, thank you for the call, Nancy. Good luck to you. This is Josh. You're on WGN.
Yeah, hi. I have a question for Dr. Most. My question is, I heard that they were coming out with the nasal spray for people that can't take the shots as a COVID-19 vaccine. When will that be available?
Josh, I would expect that the study on that will probably be late fall, maybe even early winter. Right now, the effectiveness of the nasal, even in influenza, had a big setback. So we're all really going to be careful to make sure that if we change the delivery method, that is going to work. We've had enough concerns about it. And I would say, I know there's a lot of people with needle phobias. This is one time I'd say, hey, get the Johnson & Johnson one shot and you're done. I wouldn't wait for the nasal. The nasal will probably be one that we're going to use in the future for boosters or for those if we need to have a annual or semi-annual shot.
Yeah, and I would say, to those who have a phobia about needles, I don't know if I'm phobic about needles, but I'm not crazy about them, that's for sure. I didn't even know when they injected me when I got my vaccination. It's that painless. So, don't be afraid of the needle. Here is Sherry.
And Dean, you make one really good point there, too. People that are phobic of needles, often it's because of having blood drawn. The gauge on the needle for blood drawing is huge compared to the gauge on the needle. So this is a very fine needle that's being delivered. And Sorry I stepped on you, Dean and Sherry. Yeah.
No, it's literally, I did not even feel the injection when they stuck it in me. I said, we're done? I didn't even feel anything. I was getting ready to do my usual big baby routine sitting there. Here is 217 area code. Another question perfect for Dr. Most. Would you recommend using a golf cart? And do you still recommend against using things like Uber and Lyft?
Well, I personally am not a golf cart person. I think of golf as a exercise and get out and walk. If you have a medical reason to use a golf cart, go right ahead. They have dividers right now. A lot of clubs are making you take an individual golf cart. But again, you're moving faster than you are walking when you're in a golf cart. And if you're going to play golf and you're going to get outside and you want to use a cart, go ahead. It's very safe. As far as Uber and Lyft, we know really that the chance of spreading it based on touching something in a Uber or a Lyft is one thing. The only concern I have is that the driver would continue to wear a mask. You don't know his vaccination status. You don't know your vaccination. You would know your vaccination status. But certainly, we want to be careful. And you're in a confined environment for a period of time that would be possible spread at that point.
Yeah, it would concern me that I don't know who was in that car before me, with windows closed and who knows what kind of ventilation. Could there still be a virus floating around in the air in the car if I get into a car where somebody was positive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if somebody dropped someone off and then you got right in it, very soon after. If not, I know a lot of the Uber drivers are cleaning down the cars after each ride, opening up, airing out the car. So I wouldn't be overly concerned, but certainly be cautious.
Says from the 630 area code, my husband and I got our vaccines at CDH, which was very, very well organized. Will we get proof of receiving the vaccines in a card or other form? They should have gotten a card when they got their vaccines, right?
Well, absolutely. But what we're doing at CDH and what a lot of them are doing is we're putting it into their MyChart. So two things happen there. Instead of just a card that almost anybody could duplicate, you will get a card and you can print. You'll be able to print it out with the lot numbers, the dates that you got it, your name on it, and that it happened at Northwestern. So, everyone's saying, hey, be careful. Don't show your cards online and that. This is the exact same reason. So many large systems, especially those using the Epic electronic medical record, look in your MyChart. There'll be an ability there to pull up that record and print it so that you will have the ability to have your card and proof of vaccination if needed.
Laura, you're on with Dr. Kevin Most on WGN.
Yes, hi. I had my first shot on February 11th on Moderna, and then we went out of town, and now I'm trying to schedule a second shot, but no one will schedule it and says I need to start over.
No. February 11th you went? So you're
yes.
still within the window. You just need to find a site that has Moderna vaccine. You're still well within the window. We know that that window, although we ideally, you know, 21, 28 days, depending on which vaccine, but we know that really, if you get it between under 42 days, it's ideal. And some of the studies have even showed up to 12 weeks. So you're still within that 42-day window, if my math is right. So really, you just need to find a place that has Moderna vaccine right now. And I would call the pharmacies around you, explain your situation, and see if they can't immunize you. Where did you get your first shot?
Cook County will not, you know, even schedule me. So that's what I wanted to find out.
Where did you get your first shot, Laura?
Tinley Park.
Tinley Park through Cook County or through the
yes.
mass vaccination site for FEMA?
Yes. They said I have passed the 42 days and they will not even consider it.
Oh, you are. You're in April. What am I thinking? You are past your 42 days. So that's kind of the line that's being drawn. I'm sorry, I kind of skipped a month saying you were fine. That's kind of the line that they're drawing right now. Across the world, that has been extended to 12 weeks. But now here in the United States, we're saying, hey, 42 days is really what we would like to make sure, because that's what the study showed. That's the science behind it versus what is being found out anecdotally now.
So what does Laura do? Does she go back for a first shot somewhere? Or
Yep. Tries to find Johnson & Johnson, goes back for a first shot. She's still going to get a great response. She has a good response already, even from one shot, but certainly we would rather complete the series.
Yeah, Laura, good luck to you on that. We appreciate it. And Dr. Most, we always appreciate you spending some time with us today. I hope you're going to get out and enjoy this beautiful weather today.
Dean, I'm going to have brunch in the driveway with some family and my mom, and then I think I'm going to have to go and test that golf.
Your theories? Yeah, check your golf theories. Interesting thing with Kevin, a lot of people don't know when he has a brunch in the driveway, he also has his mom change the oil in his car.
Correct. And rotate the tires.
And rotate the tires. Yeah, exactly. So it's it's win-win for everybody. Happy Easter, Kevin. Thank you, my friend.
You got to take care, Dean. We'll talk soon.
Good morning and welcome and happy Easter Sunday. Or as a friend of mine texted me this morning, happy not Greek Easter Sunday. Today is the not Greek Easter today. Greek Easter is the Eastern Orthodox Easter, more correctly put, is the first Sunday in May this year. I can't remember the formula. But Passover has to be over before there can be Greek Easter.
Okay.
That much I know. And the joke that I've been telling for years, we have Greek Easter after regular Easter so we can get the candy at half price. To which my mother would always say every year, that's not funny. You should stop. Stop telling that joke. That's not funny. People are going to believe you. So happy Easter anyway. That's the soundtrack from the movie that I'm a little bit obsessed with today, The Ten Commandments. I love this movie. I love it for its splendor, how enormous it is, and how after some 60, 65, 66, what was it, 1956, I think, that it came out. After all these years later, it's still one of the most watched television events of the year. And, you know, rightfully, you can tell why. Do you know it won an Oscar? I was making fun of the cheesy special effects in this movie. It actually did win the Oscar for best special visual effects.
Best use of a bucket of water.
And tomato soup.
You know what? It's funny you should say that. I just looked up a minute ago how they created the illusion of parting the Red Sea. And according to the IMDb website, they achieved this by with two large dump tanks that were flooded. They filmed these two dump tanks being flooded, and then they showed that in reverse. So the two walls, you know, seemed to have been
clever
parted. Gelatin was added to the water to give the water a consistency to look like seawater. It's very interesting. There's a lot of very interesting facts about this movie that I've spent way more time than really I should have today in just learning about some of these things. There were 14,000 extras in that movie. 14,000.
That's where that phrase cast of thousands comes from.
Cast of thousands. Yeah. Literally, there was literally a cast of thousands in this movie. And 15,000 animals that were used in the making of this movie. And, you know, I was just wondering, I was saying, you know, that I was a little focused on all the background players when I was watching last night, and wondering, you know, whatever happened to that kid that, you know, you saw tending the flock of geese, or, you know, this kid that was talking with the blind man. We don't know. I don't know. But I did find out, again, on the IMDb website with all this trivia about the Ten Commandments, that the scene with the infant Moses, that was Charlton Heston's newborn son at the time, Frazier Heston.
Was he as much of an overactor as well?
I don't know what you're talking
crying,
about.
Was his crying?
I don't know what labored. You're talking about.
And well.
Apparently, I want my bottle. I say I want my bottle. they say that there was a tremendous competitiveness between Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner, not so much for acting or egos, but who was going to be in the best shape for this movie, because, you know, both of them are shirtless for quite a bit of the movie. So, you know, I guess these two guys, you know, they wanted to look their best and did not want to be outshined by the other. I'll have more fascinating facts about the movie, but listen to the show anyway. it's Dean Richards. Andy Mazur, of course, is here on Sports Today, and very nice to have Bob Kessler filling in.
Great to be here,
running the newsroom, running this busy newsroom that we've heard
hard
about so much. While Dave Schwann enjoys the day off, spending Easter with his dad today, which is very, very nice. Boy, these guys could not have had a nicer Sunday.
Yeah,
if I know the Schwann brothers, they're out enjoying a nice brunch someplace right now. So good for them for enjoying that. And we had Bob did a wonderful job on our far-flung forecast that we had about a half an hour ago. Bob texted me last week and said, I'd be honored if I can do the far-flung forecast. Was it the big honor that you thought?
It was.
You thought it would be?
I love stuff like that.
Yeah.
I love a good bit.
You always have.
You know?
You always have. I've always said that about Bobby. Bob enjoys a good bit.
Good bit.
And then Andy texted me, was it yesterday?
It was yesterday.
The day before.
Yeah.
How much he enjoyed doing the far-flung forecast the last time Schwanny
right.
was out. And I said, well, I already promised Bob that he could do it, but maybe you can do it a little bit later. So, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time ever on this program, yes. we present to you the double far-flung
nice.
Forecast. It's two for Sunday, everyone.
Love that. Love that.
Our weekly compendium of fascinating facts and figures presented this week, your guest far-flung forecaster, Andy Frazier. Because that's the only name that I see on the screen
right
now, the son of Charlton Heston's newborn son. Mazur with the NCAA far-flung forecast today.
So for the second far-flung forecast today, we're going to head to East Lansing, Michigan, where the population is 48,000, as Schwani would say, 729. It's the home of a musician that once a year is celebrated for a remarkable piece of music known by many, especially those that follow college basketball. So the musician's name is David Barrett. And in 1986, while he was sitting at a bar in East Lansing watching the great Larry Bird play for the Celtics on TV, he was inspired to write a song. So the next day, he wrote the song down on a napkin, later stating that the song came fully formed and the lyrics just kind of wrote themselves.
You know, the best songs are songs
on napkins.
That are written on napkins.
Yeah, maybe there should be a song about songs about being written on napkins.
Right, right. The cocktail napkin song.
Pretty good.
Oh, my cocktail. Bob, you're a musician. You can do
write probably, stuff on cocktail napkins.
You could probably write a little song this morning.
A little ditty?
On a cocktail. Oh, give me a napkin.
Oh, I've got a cocktail napkin song.
Oh, do the napkin.
Clearly, I do not have the ability to do this. I think I've proven that over and over and over.
It was an excellent effort, though.
But you get the idea that they're always good songs. That's, you know, when I hear a musician or a singer say, yeah, you know what, this idea just came to me, and I wrote it down on a cocktail napkin.
Yeah.
First thing that I think of is, oh, Boozer. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway,
pardon me for interrupting.
So Barrett's high school friend is a guy named Armin Kantayan, who, as you probably know, worked for CBS and Sports Illustrated. And he gave him the song to see what he thought. And Kantayan then passed it on to the CBS Sports Network creative directors to see if they wanted to use it. And they intended to use it after Super Bowl 21. But CBS's allotted time for that night ran over. And this montage at the end of the game was scrubbed. So CBS asked Barrett if they could use it after the 1987 men's national championship game. He said yes, and the rest is history. The public absolutely craved it, and ever since that year, the tournament is wrapped up with Barrett's music to a montage of the best and most dramatic moments from that year's tournament. It has been sung by Barrett himself, by Teddy Pendergrass, and by the late Luther Vandross. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the ball is tipped, and there you are. David Barrett is much part of the NCAA tournament as the players and the coaches. One shining moment, of course. East Lansing today, sunny and warm, a high of 68 degrees, and right now it is 55 degrees.
When the ball is tipped, there you are. You're running for your life, you're a shooting star. All those years, no one knows just how hard you work, but now it shows. That one shining moment, you reach deep inside. In one shining moment, you knew you were alive.
I don't know if I'm more impressed with with the whole content of your far-flung forecast, or how many times you probably rehearsed doing this
post.
so you could hit the vocal to have the singing start right when you ended, which is, you know, that's the quintessential DJ trick of all DJ tricks.
Yeah, we know what we're doing in those cases. But yeah, this is an awesome song. Actually, I think this is the Teddy Pendergrass version. The one that are running right now is the Luther Vandross version on CBS, and it's believed to be the last known recording before he was sick
away.
And passed away.
Oh, wow.
So that'll be on Monday after the tournament game. We'll have the tournament game here for you as well. And I wonder if the Jalen Suggs miracle shot is going to make that montage.
Oh, you know that it has to.
I have a feeling it will.
They're working on that right now.
Exactly right.
Whatever they had planned for the broadcast for tomorrow, you know that they have to start with that. That was, I say as though I watched it, when really I was watching Edward G. Robinson on the Ten Commandments. That's one of the most spectacular moments in sports, right?
Yeah. I mean, it really wasn't used. There were a bunch of different songs that were used before that. And then this song just kind of burst onto the scene, and fans just absolutely ate it up. Now, 87 was a great NCAA tournament. Keith Smart of Indiana hit a shot at the last second to win over Syracuse. So there was a whole bunch of people watching that game. And then this song just kind of took off from there and has been used ever since.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe tomorrow they'll use my napkin song.
The Napkin Song by Dean Richards.
I wrote this on a napkin. It's the napkin song.
It can't be wrong.
See? There's a lot of words that rhyme with that. It's natural. All right. A lot of people want to check in and tell. A lot of people have their opinions about the Ten Commandments. I think mostly positive. 312-981-7200 next.
The drown in the sea. How long will the fire hold Pharaoh back?
Will it hold?
After this day,
you shall see his chariots no more.
No! You'll be dead under them.
The Lord of hosts will do battle for us. Behold his mighty hand.
Oh, ready. Ready for the Red Sea to be parted. From the Ten Commandments that was on last night, an annual tradition. Ratings for the Ten Commandments, and this has been on every single year for decades. And the ratings are still very, very impressive for this. But people are, you know, very have some very definite polarizing feelings about it. Here is one that said, Dean, I have a lifelong hatred for robe and sandal dramas thanks to your beloved Ten Commandments. It was such a big deal when it came out because of the special effects. After hearing the adults bang on for weeks of about how I would get to see the parting of the Red Sea, it was more than my little five-year-old heart could take when the sea was not, in fact, red, but just drab, muddy, brown, green. Well, I guess, you know, you're looking for accuracy there. You got a point. Sue says, I had a total meltdown watching the movie. David, how about you? Are you a fan of the Ten Commandments?
Dean, I absolutely am. And good morning, good Easter morning to
Happy
you.
Easter to you. Thank you.
Every Sunday I listen to you guys. Look, I got a lot of fun on Sunday morning.
Thank you.
I love the Ten Commandments. I've watched that thing, as I told your producer, probably 20, 30 sometimes, easily, you know? You have to watch it. I mean, the special effects, which some people could look back and say, oh, gee, well, it looks so corny now. You know, back in the day, that was cutting edge. It really was.
That was...
The cost.
It won an Oscar that year for best visual effects.
Right. I mean, the part of the Red Sea, the column of fire, I mean, the acting. I mean, come on, for God's sake. I mean, Yul Brynner, Charlton Heston. I mean, those cats were cut, man. I didn't realize those cats. They were. They were cut, man.
I believe that was the 11th commandment, which what they finally left off. Those dudes are cut.
But they really were, though. I mean, seriously, the cot. I Googled last night. I thought they were older when they made that movie. Charlton Heston was 33 when he made that movie. So they really were in their prime.
They were definitely in their prime. But think about this also, and just the making of a movie, because this was before. And I mean, you know, if they were to make a movie like that now, they could very easily digitally create everything and make it 100 times more realistic. But it was very organic, I guess you might say, back in the day. So when they had those 14,000 extras, and all the animals, they actually had
all
them there at the same time. It was all there. And somehow they, you know, commandeered it all and made it all make sense.
You're right. I mean, the cats are thousands. I mean, the horses are beautiful. I mean, the scenery. I can't, even though I know exactly what's, I can walk away from the movie, you know, go to the bathroom or whatever, come back 15 minutes later, and I know exactly what the next line is going to be, the dialogue.
Right. Yeah. I found myself speaking along with the movie, like some of the famous lines, and of course, many of the biblical passages, you know, that we all learned. But you know, I found myself talking along with the movie at the same time.
My wife and I love it. I mean, you know, each year I know exactly it's coming on ABC. I know it's going to be a long movie, so I can watch part of it, walk away from part of it, come back. And it's just a great movie. I really enjoy it. Yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic movie. I mean, and the actors, those guys acted back then. Those were great actors. They really were.
I agree completely. Yep. Thank you, David.
Love your show. But I add my two cents.
Happy Easter, David. Thank you very much for the call. This is Mike. You're on WGN.
Morning, Dean. Happy Easter.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a big fan. I've been watching it since I was a kid in the 70s. Very powerful movie. For a kid, and even now, you know, whenever I hear that narrator's voice, it just you know, really, and sometimes it can sound a little corny, but it's still very powerful. I love all the special effects. Big fan of Charlton Heston. Still can hear Yul Brynner said, "So it shall be written, so it shall be done." And then Charlton Heston mocking him, saying, "So it shall be written." And just a great movie all around.
You know who that narrator was?
Wasn't it Cecil B. DeMille?
It was the director of the movie, Cecil B. DeMille. Yep.
Yes, that's what I thought. Because he also did a movie called The Big Top that Charlton Heston was in. And he narrated that as well, which was very good, too.
That is a classic film as well. You're 100% correct. Mike, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Some of the texts, Eddie and Joliet, loved Lily Munster, Vincent Price, and Edward G. Robinson in it. I got to say that that's part of my amusement in it. Seeing, you know, the Edward G. Robinson notoriously played, you know, gangster roles. Yeah, see? In this role, Vincent Price and Lily Munster. Lily Munster is, you know, classic in the movie. This year, watching The Ten Commandments, I focused on the costumes. Very, very interesting. Yul Brynner rocks, says the 804 area code, also wins best ball head. Well, I would have to disagree with you on that. I guess we're back in the day. Back in the day,
best bald head in the 1950s.
Yeah, he was. He was a pioneer, and you know, for all of us baldies to come in later years. But yeah, I guess most people really enjoyed it. Here's my family and I watch the Ten Commandments every year as we color Easter eggs. That's a nice tradition. 773 area code said play Billy Crystal doing the movie. Billy Crystal has a very funny bit that he does about that movie. And Mel Brooks, I might add, coming down from the mountaintops with his 15 commandments. I'm going to play that for you. Thank you for reminding me. We'll get to that coming up in a few minutes. Pandemic Week in Theater special. You know, usually we would tell you about shows that are opening in the Chicago area. Mostly it's been virtual. It's got an incredibly interesting production to tell you about that you can participate in coming up in a couple of minutes. But some theater news. There was actually a performance that took place on Broadway over the weekend. Nathan Lane and Savion Glover put on an impromptu show as a benefit and with a very small audience, but still a live performance on Broadway. They are still looking forward to bringing shows back to Broadway and getting that up and running again, as we are here in Chicago. Also looking forward to shows, you know, back up and running again. A couple of theater companies have announced schedules for things that they're hoping will happen in the fall. They've put out the schedules, but, you know, honestly, it's anybody's guess. All depends on what happens with the virus. All depends on whether numbers begin to go down and it begins to be more safe for people to get together, for casts to be together again on stage, for crews backstage, you know, to be together again. So we're going to keep an eye on that. But in the meantime, tell you about some interesting things that are going on. When I think about the Lyric Opera, I think about, you know, obviously they're beautiful operatic works that go on. It did go on until the pandemic started. And then the Lyric Opera opened up to doing classic Broadway musicals once a year as well. And these have just been some of the best performances that we have had in Chicago of musical theater. I saw Oklahoma there. That was stunning. I still get goosebumps literally thinking about the production of Carousel that I saw there. Sound of Music was another that was spectacular that I saw there. And the list goes on and on of shows. But Lyric Opera is going to be doing something really different, which is going to be a shortened version of the finale of Wagner's Ring Cycle that will take place at the end of this month and the beginning of next month in the Millennium Park Lakeside Garage. on the multi-levels of the Millennium Park Lakeside Garage. And people will view these shows from their cars. This is just an amazingly creative idea. And Anthony Freud is the general director, president, and CEO of the Lyric Opera. Anthony, it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome.
And nice great to join you this morning, Dean. Thank you for inviting me.
So
thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate hearing your memories of times when we could welcome people to the Lyric Opera House, which we'll be able to do again before too long, I'm sure.
I'm hoping, you know, I keep thinking about what it's going to be like first nights at all these theaters around Chicago and around the country and around the world where people are going to be able to see live performances again. I can only imagine thunderous ovations. Go ahead.
We have brand new seats in the Lyric Opera House, too. We've been able, thanks to a very generous grant from an anonymous foundation, we've been able to reseat the entire Opera House from top to bottom, realigning rows, increasing the number of accessible spaces.
Nice.
So when people do return to the Opera House, they will be greeted with a whole new level of experience. So I'm very excited about that, too.
I'm very excited to hear about that. But I got to talk to you about this production that you're putting on where the seating is going to be in my vehicle with the, you know, probably with a seatbelt on. This is such a clever way of presenting this. Explain exactly what it is that you're going to be doing.
Well, you may remember that the first thing we had to cancel because of COVID, because of the pandemic, was the very long-planned, brand-new production of Wagner's Ring. Three complete cycles and a new production of the last of the four operas, The Twilight of the Gods, Götterdämmerung. And we've been working through last year with Yuval Sharon, who is a brilliant, brilliant reimaginer of opera and theater. And he actually came to me with this idea and said, how about if we performed a 60 or 70 minute reimagining of Wagner's Twilight of the Gods, but for the entire performance to take place in a parking garage with all the audience watching and listening from within their cars. And of course, I thought this was a wonderfully crazy idea. And Yuval being Yuval, who is an incredibly serious artist, not only with a brilliant imagination, but also with an ability to deliver what he imagines, I thought, well, this has to be worth exploring. And so here we are, about 8 or 9 months later, about to present Twilight Gods, as you say, at the Millennium Lakeside Parking Garage, opening on April 28th. And what will happen is that within the parking garage, there will be six different installations, so to speak, involving singers, involving members of our orchestra, involving projections, involving a narration by the wonderful Chicago multidisciplinary artist Avery R. Young. And you'll be directed, along with eight other cars, into your place around the first installation. And you'll spend about 5 minutes enjoying the performance that will be given at that installation. Then you and your eight other cars will be directed to installation number two. And in the meantime, eight or nine new cars will be directed to installation number one, et cetera, et cetera. And so through the course of each of the performance cycles, I suppose you would call it, the artists at each installation will have to perform and repeat their 5 minute selection seven times to seven different groups of eight or nine cars. And we're repeating that over the course of 3 days.
That's so fantastic. And you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car, listening on your car radio. Is that right?
Yes, yes. Partly for artistic reasons and partly for safety reasons, we are advising people to have their windows wound up and to listen on their car radios. Because if you think about it, if there are a range of cars in different places around each installation, it's hard for the live music to be heard acceptably to all of those cars. And so the way to solve that is by transmitting that performance onto everyone's car radio with a different frequency at each installation. And I know it sounds complicated, but believe me, it's really simple and really straightforward, and there'll be many people on hand to guide and direct members of the audience. You will be listening through your car radio.
Yeah, so at one installation, they'll tell you to dial your radio to such and such a frequency. When you go to the next one, they tell you to dial your radio to a different frequency. It's just really changing. It's like changing stations on your radio as you change stations of performance for this. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the only disadvantage of this whole project is that capacity is limited. And although you can fit as many people into your car as you choose, the number of cars who can actually experience it in the parking garage over those three performance cycles is limited. But the good news is that we're going to be filming the experience for future streaming. And so people will be able to catch up with that experience virtually rather than in person from, we hope, the middle of June by the time the film will be ready.
That's it just sounds so amazingly creative and fun. And something to do, you know, people are just looking for something to do. Here's a way to get out of your house, stay within your bubble, watch some live performances in probably the most creative manner in which you have ever watched any live performance before.
One of the challenges of this reimagined year, and we've long since stopped calling it a dark year just because so much has been happening, one of the opportunities of the reimagined year is a chance to reinvent, to pivot, to be flexible, to rethink. And in a way, Twilight Gods is the perfect encapsulation of our efforts to be imaginative and to reinvent our art form. And my hope is that as we return to the Opera House and as live performances return to all our lives, we'll continue to be really imaginative and inventive, because the new world is certainly going to be very different from the pre-COVID world.
Yeah.
And we've been doing a lot of virtual activity online, music making, opera, introductions to music. And our online programs have already been seen by over 180,000 people, which is more than 55 sold-out houses in the Opera House.
Wow.
So that's going to be a very important part of our future lives, too. I do believe that virtual art is here to stay alongside live art, which is, of course, what we're also excited to return to.
Sure, sure. Now, the performance in the Millennium Park Lakeside Garage is already sold out, unfortunately. But
But you can put your name on a wait list if you want to see if you can get return tickets. But also, if you have not been able and won't be able to come in person, then please remember you'll be able to catch up with it online as the whole experience is going to be filmed.
Yeah, very exciting either way. Now, you mentioned the new seats in the theater itself. What else have you been, you know, planning? When things go back to being live again, is there, you know, a plan A, plan B, plan C, depending on how things reopen?
I think there are barely enough letters in the alphabet to demonstrate the number of scenarios that we've been modeling. Certainly, yes, we have a very clear plan A, and that plan A, COVID permitting, is what we hope to be announcing in the middle of May for the reopening of Lyric Opera at the Lyric Opera House. And of course, also performing in the Opera House will be the Joffrey Ballet, who are our new partners as the resident ballet company of the Opera House. That was all supposed to start last season, which of course never took place because of the pandemic. But yes, we're bursting with eagerness to get going, to get back into the Opera House, always acknowledging that our top priority is the safety of our audiences, our artists, and our staff, and juggling the enthusiasm to return to the Opera House with the appropriate protocols and cautions surrounding the circumstances, and Dean, you outlined some of the complexities in the introduction to this, it is a constant ongoing process, and one that we are taking extremely seriously, and one that we are confident we can balance appropriately, and from September, crossing fingers and crossing toes, COVID permitting, we'll be back in the Opera House performing great opera to 3,000 plus people in our wonderful new seats.
Yeah, well, I sure can't wait for that. As I said, you know, Lyric Opera productions are always, you know, my favorites and always mind-blowing. You know, I've said in reviews of shows there, nothing is ever held back at the Lyric Opera for productions that are put on there. That's why it's always such a magical experience. You know, whatever will come, we'll look forward to. In the meantime, I love that somebody in a 1970 Pinto can come in a drive-through the Millennium Garage and come and experience this production of the Ring Cycle.
And just think of this, Brunhilde's final act in The Ring is to ride into the funeral pyre on her horse, Grana. And if you're performing Twilight Gods in a parking garage, what is the perfect representation of Brunhilde's magic horse?
Got to be a Mustang.
A Mustang, of course.
Yep, perfect sense.
That's what there will be.
I love it. I love it from top to bottom. It's fantastic. I can't wait to. We're gonna come and you know, see it with our TV cameras and you know, kind of give everyone a little preview on WGN TV. Anthony, it's wonderful to talk to you. Congratulations on getting through this. This is not an easy time for people who run venues around America and around the world. You know, thank goodness, you know, you're there to kind of steady the ship as we get through all of this. Appreciate you joining
us. Thank you, Dean. Thank you very much for having me.
Anthony Freud is the general director, the president, and the CEO of Lyric Opera. In a minute, This Day in Theater History remembers one of the classics. Next.
The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.
And our Week in Theater segment, saluting This Day in Theater History, as we've been doing during the pandemic. Lots of you really enjoying just hearing a little theater history and some of the tunes that go along with those dates. Like, for example, this date in 2013, Kinky Boots opened on Broadway at the Al Hirschfeld Theater there, based on the 2005 movie of the same name, the book written by Harvey Fierstein, music and lyrics by Cyndi Lauper. Aaron Carter, the teen idol, joined the cast of the struggling Broadway musical Seussical on this day in 2001. Now, in the year of 1964, it was an example of even how superstars can have bombs on Broadway. 1964, a show called Anyone Can Whistle opened up. Music was written by Stephen Sondheim, and it starred Angela Lansbury. The show lasted only 9 performances. And finally, on this day in 2001, 42nd Street came home to 42nd Street, where a new Broadway revival of the show opened at the Ford Center for Performing Arts there. The production won the 2001 Tony Award for Best Revival of a Musical, and it ran 1,524 performances.
Who writes the words and music for all the girly shows? No one cares and no one knows. Who is the handsome hero? Some villain always frames. But who cares if there's a plot? Or not, when they've got a lot of dance. What do you go for? Go see a show for. Tell the truth, you go to see those beautiful dames. You send your dough for bouquets.
that grow for all those cute and cunning, young and beautiful days. Dames are temporary flames. Do you, dames? You don't recall their names, do you? But their caresses and home addresses linger in your memory of those beautiful, in your memory. See those beautiful, in your memory, all those beautiful days.
I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.
I love that. The great Mel Brooks. History of the world. Recreating the sea, spoofing the Ten Commandments. Charlton Heston coming out with the Ten Commandments. He comes out with the 15. Oi! Ten Commandments.
The oi really sells it.
The oi is the best part of that whole scene. Love it. Coming up in about a half an hour, we will be joined by Ted Neely, who played Jesus himself in the original movie musical, Jesus Christ Superstar. He's part of a making-of documentary on that classic film, so we'll talk with him on that coming up in just a little while. I saw something pop up on the Tribune's website this morning, Andy, that you may have a word or two about.
Okay.
They are speculating that the All-Star game may be coming to Wrigley Field.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of talk about where the All-Star game will go now that Major League Baseball decided to take it away from Atlanta. There is some thought, too, about Los Angeles because it was supposed to be there last year. Of course, there was no All-Star game last year. Yeah. So that's a possibility as well. I know that Governor Pritzker has certainly made it known that both Chicago baseball stadiums would be available to them if they wanted to use them. It would be only seem right if it was Wrigley, because the last time that Wrigley hosted an All-Star game was 1990.
Been a long time.
And, you know, I think that there were certain promises that were made I don't know if it was out in front or out in public, but, you know, when the Ricketts went through the transformation of Wrigley Field to put the video boards in the neighborhood, and, you know, there's a lot of talk that when that happens, Major League Baseball looks really at those stadiums and said, okay, it's time for an All-Star game to showcase that particular facility. A lot of the new parks have gotten All-Star games before Wrigley's gotten another one.
It's hard to believe that. How many years has it been now with all the upgrades and the the screens in Wrigley Field,
yeah,
or what I've been calling the Disneylandization,
yeah,
of Wrigleyville. You go there now, and it's like you're walking down Main Street USA.
Yeah, it's a lot different.
Disneyland.
Yeah, it's a lot different. I know that the project that they had began shortly, I believe, after the 14 season ended, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
Right. So definitely not for an All-Star game, for sure. Then.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting too, because I didn't know what to expect going there to cover a game or even to watch a game in person, what the experience would be like with all the video boards and things like that. And I got to give the Cubs a lot of credit, because they haven't succumbed to the old kiss cam, muscle cam, dance cam kind of stuff. They're using the video boards to showcase guys like Ron Santo and Ernie Banks and Billy Williams, and educating some younger fans about what happened before they were born. And I really like the way that they've done things.
Yeah, well, don't act like you don't love the kiss cam, though.
Well, in certain aspects of it, yes, but not at Wrigley Field.
Not at Wrigley Field?
No, I mean, that's the whole thing, you know, because they were the last park to get lights, obviously, and that iconic scoreboard in center field was the only thing going. I mean, I learned how to add, I think, from looking at all the little numbers up there to figure out which team was actually winning. They got this coded system to figure out who the pitchers are, because they don't put the pitcher's actual number up for other games in the Cubs game. So there's a little key in the scorecard that you have to go look and see, pitcher number two. Okay, that's so-and-so. And it was always fascinating and entertaining in and of itself just to go to the game.
Right.
You know, now you have extra distractions, if you will, but obviously you have to keep up with the times, and you got to keep up with the brain span or the attention span of younger audiences at this point, that they are glued to their phones a lot, and you got to entertain them as well.
I like the distractions.
Yeah,
I like kiss cam. I wouldn't mind a kiss cam at Wrigley Field or some of the other distractions. I love watching the various sausages race.
Well, yeah, that's live. That's cool. I mean,
they do that up on the screen too? Isn't there? Or is it a Dunkin' Donuts?
Oh, no, the one
are they donuts
one at Wrigley,
racing?
The one at Wrigley is I believe it was the beef company, the Bona Beef Company.
Right.
They had the beef races.
Yeah, I love that.
The sausages, I think, were in
Milwaukee.
Well, the actual race on the field, but I remember being at Wrigley, and I just seem to remember like an animated, I thought it was sausage.
It could be some
other beef product that was engaging in an animated
in a
race.
Yes, and the possibility does exist, to get back to the original question, but it does exist. Again, I would caution anybody to get too excited about it yet, because there's a decision on that's going to have to be made soon, because this is going to be a situation where whatever franchise is hosting this event is going to be at a competitive disadvantage of planning,
right?
Because these things are usually planned for a couple of years ahead of time. They'll know what they're going to have an All-Star game to get ready for. So
I wonder if there's going to be some negative feedback as a result of it also.
There has been.
Whoever accepts it, because there has already been negative feedback of people saying baseball should have stayed out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
People are upset that Major League Baseball took a stand like that, when really, in fact, other sports have also taken
this is not new
on things like this. It's just that Major League Baseball never did it.
No, this is the first time, I believe, for Major League Baseball to do something like this. And Jason Hayward was interviewed after the game yesterday, saying how impressed he was that Major League Baseball acted without player pressure. Now, the Players Alliance has obviously come out and thought that it should have been moved just because of inequality things with the voting laws and everything like that in Georgia. But Major League Baseball did this on their own. And, I'm sure they had feedback from the players in some respect before they went ahead and did it. But Major League Baseball kind of acted on its own.
Is it being generally well received
by the players? Yes.
By the players?
Yeah, by the players, yes. There's obviously groups that are not happy with Major League Baseball. You kind of feel bad for the folks that were going to work the game in Atlanta, because who knows what their political leanings are. It doesn't really matter. I mean, they're not going to be able to do their what they were preparing to do for a couple of years, and that certainly is a bad thing for them personally, and for the city of Atlanta as well. I mean, it's a lot of tourism and a lot of dollars coming into that city.
Yeah.
And that will no longer be the case.
Yeah, I get it. But, you know, I get that. I think it was Martin Luther King's daughter who said that the people who are going to be most impacted by this are poor people who are going to stand to benefit by the games taking place there.
Right.
But she said, you know, this is an important stand that has to that Major League Baseball is making about, you know, people's voting rights at the same time. And the future of democracy. I mean, she talked about it, understanding one side, but saying, you know, that it's very important on the other side that we take a stand with something like this. Sometimes you got to take a stand for something that you believe in. And the people who are saying Major League Baseball, you know, shouldn't take their stand, they're just expressing their opinion with an action, just like people who are criticizing them are expressing an opinion. And some people say, oh, I'm going to boycott Major League Baseball. I'm not going to watch baseball anymore. You're entitled to do that if you disagree with an action that's being taken. It's the beauty of America. You can have your own opinion on that.
Yeah, and Jason Hayward basically said it yesterday too. He said, listen, you're not going to please everybody. You're not going to make everybody happy by the decision to keep it there or to remove it. So, you know, Major League Baseball had to come to terms on its own and say, okay, well, we're not going to deal with this. We're not going to stand for it. And you're losing the game and someone else is going to get it.
Yeah. As much as I would like to see it be here, it seems like it makes sense that the Dodgers should get it since they missed out on it last year.
Yeah, and it'd been a while since Dodger Stadium had hosted it as well. You know, because all these new parks are popping up that you want to show off the shiny new toy, and you forget about the relics, so to speak, that got you there to be able to build these new stadiums, because Wrigley Field and Dodger Stadium are the two oldest in the National League. And obviously Fenway Park is the oldest in all of baseball. So it would be nice to be able to feature one of those older stadiums again.
Have you've been to, I would guess, most of the fields, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Are those old fields really cool and classic, or are they dilapidating and falling apart?
No, actually.
You're afraid a chunk of concrete's going to fall on your head when you're walking down the concourse.
Dodger Stadium, I spend more time at Dodger Stadium than I have at the other older parks, obviously Wrigley Field and Dodger Stadium being out in California. And that stadium, you wouldn't even realize that it was built in 1962. I mean, you wouldn't even know it. I mean, if you didn't have any clue walking in, you'd think, okay, this is one of these
new
baseball stadiums. It's clean. It's really nice. The field is well manicured. They've updated the facilities for the visiting players and for the home team. And same thing for Fenway Park. And Fenway Park, basically, I think, was served as a little bit of a model for what the folks at Wrigley did, because they saw how engaged the fan base was with the fact that you're doing this to the oldest stadium in Major League Baseball, and it works.
You keep the integrity of the old park
and still
update at the same time.
Exactly.
And the question is, whoever winds up getting it, how many people are going to be able to go to it? It's not going to be like a regular All-Star game. It's going to be very limited capacity in whatever stadium winds up getting it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because across Major League Baseball right now, it's not universal as to how many fans can be in each ballpark. It's by government locale, basically, is what it is. We're in Texas, in Arlington, Texas, at the new stadium for the Rangers, they're allowing 100% capacity for this first series. And then there's others that are up to about 40. And then obviously here in Chicago, it's 20 or 22. And it's different across the landscape of the league. So it's not uniform at this point. So I don't know. I mean, it kind of depends, I think, where the game is and where it ends up as to what that government locale will be able to tell them how many fans can be there.
It starts to get to be a political thing then, but I wouldn't be comfortable in a stadium that's allowing 100% capacity, would you?
No.
I wouldn't want to go to a game like that.
At this point, no. And it's really kind of contradictory, too, because they're talking about having 100% fan base allowed the first week, and then they're going to scale it back for the rest of April and May. This is a new stadium, and it got kind of pushed aside because of the pandemic, and it did host the National League Championship Series and the World Series. That was the bubble location for those playoffs. But they want to show off this shiny new toy that they spent $2.5 billion on, or whatever it is that I think it was actually even more than that.
Yeah. Not at the expense of getting people sick, though.
I think that might be, you know, kind of what's happening there.
Not when they have those perfectly good cardboard cutouts that they could put in the stand.
Yeah, those are kind of cool.
Are they still using those anyplace?
You know, I don't think they are. I know they're using them at the NCAA tournament right now, replicating the student section, because students weren't able to get there and get organized and have their own sections. I saw that in the UCLA crowd last night. That there's people sitting in between the cardboard cutouts. So, you know, those old stories about when those cutouts were going on last year, there were people wanting to buy beers for them, you know? Here, have a beer.
They probably didn't even, they were so full of beer themselves, they didn't realize that they were sitting next to a cardboard cutout.
Man, this guy's a stiff sitting next to me. He doesn't even talk, he won't talk to me or anything.
This guy's rude next to me.
What an idiot.
See, Conan O'Brien's show for pretty much during the whole pandemic, he's doing a show from a remote location, a theater in the L.A. area. The entire audience is cardboard cutouts. So
it's unbelievable.
It's hilarious.
And last year there was a game, I think, at Dodger Stadium where some of the players had purchased those of their family. And there was a couple in the outfield, and a guy hit a home run and literally knocked the head off his kid. The ball landed and took the kid's head off.
Love that.
Of the cardboard cutout, and that was quite a thing.
Could only be better if we heard the Russian play-by-play of that happening.
Wait a minute, you know, the Russian play-by-play of something? Would you settle for just you know, just about anything?
Yes. I love that.
Pretty good.
I don't know if I'm more obsessed with that or the Ten Commandments that I watched last night now, because I'm definitely obsessed with both of them, that's for sure.
I wonder if there's Russian radio stations playing the English version and
laughing,
giggling a little bit at our expense.
They're laughing at those Amerikanskis. All right, Ted Neely from Jesus Christ Superstar is coming up next.
Dean Richards, Sunday morning, Chicago's WGN Radio 720. Jesus
Christ, happy Easter Sunday morning. Maybe you first saw Jesus Christ Superstar as a stage musical. One of the most popular in the history of live theater. Then became a motion picture in 1973, movie musical that really turned the movie business over on its head. It became the biggest selling movie of that year. Its star, a young actor by the name of Ted Neely, playing Jesus Christ Superstar. We have been fortunate to have him here in Chicago many times, and many times visiting with us here in WGN. And Ted Neely joins us on the phone line right now. Good morning, my friend. Happy Easter to you.
Happy Easter to you too, Dean. How's it going there?
Doing very, very well. How has your week been? Is this your busy time of year, isn't it? You're like a tax accountant this time of year.
It is amazing, absolutely amazing. I can't believe all this response is happening to. It's just incredible.
Could you have possibly anticipated the kind of response this movie would have had when it first opened, and it was blockbuster? But all these years later, now people still look back fondly as one of, you know, the great movies of all time for them.
I can't, it's hard for me to even respond, literally, because honestly, Dean, when we were making the film in Israel, we didn't even know if it would be released, because it was the first rock opera ever made, and the studios weren't really interested in that sort of thing, the film studios, but our brilliant genius director, Norman Jewison, visionary gentleman, was able to put it all together and make it work, and look what we're doing here now. Yeah. I can't believe today we're sitting here talking about it still, because it was a couple of years back, right,
when it came out? One or two, we may have been slightly younger than Ted when this first came out. But I'm just trying to remember the reaction to when this came out. I mean, there were a lot of people, mostly young people, who thought, wow, you know, these are the stories that my, you know, my parents have been teaching me. These are the stories I learned in Bible school and Sunday school all these years. But it's speaking to me in a different way now. It's speaking to me in a language that is for my generation. So there was that. But on the other hand, I clearly remember friends of mine whose parents absolutely would not let them go see what they called that blasphemy on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. And it happened that way when we did the Broadway show in 1971. They protested it in the streets there in New York every single night. So it was nothing new that there was people saying, no, my children are not going to watch that. But little by little, they all were courageous enough to watch it themselves, and then they loved it.
Yeah.
That's what happened in New York, literally, when the people were outside, literally every single night. And we had to push our way through the crowd to get into the backstage to go to the theater. And they would be, I would say, well, excuse me, sir, but what is it you don't like about the film? And they'd say, we hate the title. It's sacrilegious, just the title alone.
Right,
and
right.
I didn't respond because I didn't want to fight with them. Then I'd say, well, is there anything else? Yeah, we hear that Jesus sings. Jesus didn't sing. And, of course, I was thinking, were you there?
Yeah, he didn't put out an album, but he may have sung.
Yeah, and then I would get one person who seemed a little cool, and I said, would you be my guest? Just come in the theater, watch the show, wait till the end, I'll come out and talk with you. You can tell me what you hate about the show.
Yeah.
The ones who were brave enough to cross the threshold would wait for me at the end, and I'd walk into the lobby, and they'd go, we love your show, man, it's incredible. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I mean, you couldn't accident, you know, sort of be incognito either. I mean, who's that guy that looks exactly like Jesus walking into the backstage of the theater?
And that was even without the robe on, you know?
Right. There's Jesus in street clothes walking into the...
Jesus in Levi's.
So it's been amazing how this film has touched people over the years. You know, people still talk about it over and over, and that's why this new documentary, which is out now, that explains the making of this film and really takes you behind the scenes. I think it's just so incredibly interesting. It's called Superstars Extended Version. Ted, explain what this is.
Actually, it's something that Frank Munoz and I did a few years back, because we were just putting things together with our friends who were part of the cast and the crew and the band and all that. It was a family experience when we were there in Israel. So we wanted to have something to remember each other by, literally. And now we decided that, well, since we've had it out for a while, but nobody even knows because we just did it ourselves, didn't even distribute it. We just had some copies on the table there when we would do our screenings and so on. So anyway, so this one, reason we put this one out now is because of what you're talking about, and it's definitely behind the scenes. There's interviews with us all the time we were shooting the film in Israel. And so you have an individual segment with each one of the eight principals. And we have some magnificent photographs that have never before been seen by David James, our photographer, who was with us in Israel the entire time. And so all the stories of each one of the characters is weaved around those photographs. And they're just beautiful to see. And everyone that I have spoken with who has seen it, they say they cry all the way through it because it's such a personal thing with these actors.
When you talk with the surviving cast members now, what's the general feeling about what that experience was like? Because it couldn't have been easy being in the Middle East in 1970, 1971, something like
72.
That. I think you told me this was just shortly after the Six-Day War took place.
Well, that's what they told us, you know, when we were going over there, but it was still going. They were bombing the borders everywhere around us.
Yeah.
You know, when you shoot a film, generally what you hear most is action and cut from the director. Well, this was action, cut, and hit the dirt, because here comes the jets, and there's the tanks.
Yeah.
You see, that's why those tanks and jets were actually in the film. Mr. Jewison was able to get them to take a day off and come over there with us.
No kidding.
But the thing about it was everything that we experienced, literally, was as if we were walking in the footsteps of the people we were portraying. because Mr. Jewison could have shot this film in any desert anywhere,
sure.
But he wanted to have the reality of what we were doing present. And believe me, it was so present, it was magnificent.
Yeah, I've heard so many, I've never been to the Holy Land, but I've heard from so many people how profoundly moving it is, even if you're not a deeply religious or spiritual person, to be in these historic places that are named in the Bible.
You're absolutely right, you're there. You've heard about it, whether you believe or not, that's beside the point. But the atmosphere's there. It just we couldn't go anywhere without feeling these things. It just, especially when we did the sequences, like say the Last Supper, when we were in Herod the Great's palace. After that, with all most of the other sequences. We were walking where they walked, you know, and everything you see in that film was historical. It was there. The only thing that we built was the moat for the Herod song, and they put that moat on the Dead Sea. And then for the Last Supper, when we were in the Garden of Gethsemane, when they went there, there was no grass at all. It was just sand and rocks. So Norman Jewison sent guys from the crew to plant the grass so we would have a lovely green carpet sitting there when we were doing it. It was just absolutely amazing, and it changed our lives. Everybody's lives were changed for the better.
Yeah.
And we are so close together, the reserving ones, I should say.
Yeah.
Barry Dannon and Carl Anderson both have passed, but the rest of us, my goodness, we get together as often as possible.
How did you even get involved with this in the first place, Ted? I mean, it did change your life, but were you a working actor then? Were you a working musician?
Completely by accident, my friend. I was playing with my band in California, and things happened. When we arrived, we became the stars of Hollywood and Beverly Hills because we were the only band who weren't playing surfer music at the time. And I'm not denigrating surfer music. I loved it. But we were a bunch of guys from Texas playing rock and roll, and we were doing everybody else's music and trying to copy it so we sounded exactly like the record.
Yeah.
They used to refer to us as it was a weekend human jukebox, What you want to hear, we'll play.
Right.
So the whole thing happened by accident, by being there and people coming in and seeing us in the nightclubs where we played. I was actually out there after all of that, after we did the Broadway show, and my goodness, I was sent out there to do Tommy at the same theater where we did Hair originally. And I read in the Hollywood Reporter that Norman Jewison is in town auditioning people for his motion picture, Jesus Christ Superstar. And my heart just jumped up into my throat. My goodness. Now, when you're doing these shows and you're in rehearsals, which we were, you can't get out of it to rehearsals to go do something because you're there all day and into the night doing performances. So I contacted the agency for Norman Jewison so I could talk to his agent. He actually responded to my call. I said I would like very much to have Mr. Jewison to come and see the show as the audition. And he said, well, hold on just a minute. And I held on for a second. He came right back and said, I just talked to Norman. He'd love to see the show. When would you like him to come? And I said, anytime he wants, but don't let me know he's there because it will scare me and I'll probably forget all the lyrics to the song.
Right.
Anyway, the show he came to see was on a matinee and an evening performance. And in the matinee, I was injured, knocked out cold on stage by accident. But it was okay for me to finish the second act. But the doctor said, you shouldn't go on at the evening performance because there's a dizziness there. You might hurt yourself. Well, that's the show that Norman came to see. I wasn't even there.
Wow. How about that?
Here I'm trying to do something and blah, blah, blah. So the agent the next day called me and said, you blew it. Norman came last night and you weren't there.
Oh.
He says, now what would you have me do? I said, would you call him and see if we could have lunch so I can apologize?
Yeah.
Well, he actually did that. We had lunch. It was a great lunch. And he said, I just want you to know, Ted, we've already cast all of our principals, but I'll keep you in mind for future projects. Long story getting even longer, my goodness. Fade out, we finished Tommy. Now we're at the Universal Amphitheater doing the first national tour of Superstar at that Universal Theater. It was a beautiful place. And I got a call one night. Norman, Jewison called me and said, Ted, I'm going to be back in Los Angeles soon, and I'd like to come see the show, and I'll talk to you then. Anyway, the bottom line was, and nothing worked with that either. So when we're doing the ready to go on and do our opening night performance of Superstar, I get a call the night before telling me that he's going to bring me to London to do a screen test. Because people had told him, he said, she'd see this guy who sings the part. So anyway, he did do that. And then halfway through the whole performance action of Superstar there at the amphitheater, he calls and said, Ted, you're my Jesus.
Wow. Wow. What a call. Literally. What a call to me. You're my Jesus.
Yes, that's right. And I said, well, excuse me, sir, who's your Judas? He said, well, of course it's Carl, because you guys did that screen test together, and you look just like what I wanted to see in my film.
Yeah.
So there you go.
That's amazing.
Lucky, 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 lucky.
That is just amazing. Like, you know, you think about how much you try to plan your life and your career, and sometimes just things happen, right? And
oh, I'm telling you, you couldn't say it more specifically. It just happened. You know, I'm a rock and roll screaming drummer from Texas. I never had any even thoughts of going into theater. I had no training, none of that. I was happy sitting on the drums and screaming. You know, it's cool.
right.
But it happened, and I could not be more thankful.
That's amazing. We'll tell you more about Superstar's extended version, the 93-minute documentary on the making of Jesus Christ Superstar, the movie, and how you can watch it for free this Easter weekend. I'll tell you how you can see it in some other places as well. Ted Neely is with us on the line, played Jesus in the motion picture, and we're going to open up the phone lines for some questions, comments about the movie, 312-981-7200 to call or text. Next on WGN.
Show me there's a reason for you wanting me to die. Far too keen on where and how, but not so hot on why. Just watch me die.
Gethsemane from the soundtrack. From back in the day, but I'll tell you something. I've seen Ted do this, you know, fairly recently. He can still hit those high notes. That's amazing. Amazing that you can still do that, Ted.
Well, I'm scared all the time, you see.
So. Is that it?
I got a lot of help there, you know.
You obviously take very good care of your instrument.
Yes, sir, I do.
Yeah, of your voice. This is Monica on the phone line, calling up from Northeast Pennsylvania this morning on WGN.
Oh, my goodness.
Nice to have you with us, Monica. Hello.
Hi. Hello. I am a huge, huge fan, hence why I'm calling all the way from Northeast Pennsylvania. It is an honor to talk to you, Ted Neely.
Thank you for calling, Monica. Thank you.
Oh, yes, it is my honor. I've been a fan since a small child.
That's wonderful. And you still appreciate it after all this time?
Oh, yes. See, it's funny. I was raised in a mostly non-religious, like, household, and Jesus Christ Superstar was really, like, the only telling of the Jesus story that I really knew growing up. But I think it's really one of, like, the most honest tellings of it. And I think it's so interesting how it was so, like, anti-religious back in the day, and now I see that, like, you know, religious people love Jesus Christ Superstar now. So I wanted to ask you, like, when did that change happen?
Actually, it probably happened yesterday. No, I got to tell you, it started to happen when we were doing a Broadway show back in 71, because people came and protested every single performance, and the ones that I was able to talk into coming in to just see the show and wait for me in the lobby to tell me what they hated, I'd go to the lobby and they would say, we love this show, it's incredible. Yeah. So once you look at it, something happens.
Touches
a button somehow, right, Dean?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it changes probably every time somebody sees the film or a production of it. When you see what it actually is, you don't prejudge it without seeing it.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's the case. Monica?
You know, and the whole idea is that you know, Tim Rice went into the first four books of the New Testament to get the essence of the story for his lyrics of the songs. And then Norman Jewison adapted the songs into his screenplay. And then we did what we did. And it was Norman's vision to put all those wonderful things in there. But without Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber, we wouldn't have had one, would we?
Yeah. Monica, thank you for the call, and thank you for listening this morning. This is Hap and Desplaines. You're on WGN with Ted Neely.
Good morning, gentlemen. Ted, I really enjoyed Superstar when it came out. I bought the vinyl album and all that sort of thing. But one objection, the only really objection I had to the movie was there was no mention of the resurrection. And that's been a criticism I've heard over the years about the movie, that it covered so much of his life, but there was never anything about the resurrection. Could you comment on that?
I certainly could, and I felt that way exactly from the first time I got involved with it. And I talked extensively with Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber about that, and then certainly with Norman Jewison. Norman felt the same way. Norman even had conversations with him even when we were in Israel to talk about the resurrection, because we all felt it needed that. But Tim literally felt that because of the way that they wrote the album, they had no real idea of doing Broadway shows and theater companies and movies. They were just doing what they wanted to do with this rock opera. And so he has a great sense of humor. And he said to us, well, we think we might do part two, and we'll just start with the resurrection.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Patricia in Bronzeville, you're on WGN with Ted Neely.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Neely. I want to tell you, years ago when that movie first came out and we were born again Christians, when all that was the rage, you know how many years ago that was. My sister thought your movie was out of sight, and I thought it was a horrible abomination, and I refused to watch it any further. But hitherto, I have purchased the DVD over the past maybe 5 years ago, and in light of the culture today, the horrible, degraded culture that we live in today, your film was predictive in that, with the women sparsely dressed and the colorful Afro wigs and the colored hair, that's what they're doing today. And then it was slightly portrayed that Herod was a homosexual with the men, with sitting on the men's booties, rubbing back and forth, and I thought, oh, how horrible, but that's what's celebrated today, isn't it? But that movie was predictive about today, and that man who played the man that held your head, that was stellar when he came down those stairs and said, who is this little man? It just ripped my heart out when you talked to him, and your song in the Garden of Gethsemane is just pulled my heart out, and a poor man has died. He really played that part, the black guy that played Judas.
He really played
that movie is off the chain in my mind. Nobody can ever speak against that. I love it.
How about that?
God has blessed you tremendously. I've seen you singing on YouTube where you can still sing, like he said, those high notes.
Yep.
You are blessed, and that movie is predictive of today, where we live in this horrible culture today.
All right, Patricia, thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Wow, you went from abomination to off the chain, Ted.
I know. What a great review.
Yes, it was a very interesting one, for sure. So
yeah.
The extended version, the documentary, Superstar's extended version, is being shown on the Tubi streaming platform free all this Easter weekend. In fact, actually through tomorrow. If you go to Tubi, T-U-B-I, you can watch Jesus Christ, the documentary. It will be on video on demand for rental or purchase for the rest of the month of April on Vimeo. And then the official street date will be August the 10th, which is the 48th anniversary of the film, on the multiple streaming channels, on Blu-ray and on DVD. Highly recommend it. And Ted, it's always wonderful to talk to you, to say hello, and I look forward to when we can get you back in the studio here again and visit in person.
Oh, can I say one more quick thing to you?
Please.
Regardless, first of all, thank you for what you just did, because I was wanting to have to say that. You said it so beautifully, I could not possibly say it that way. But I just want to say, We're trending on Tubi. I can't believe it.
No kidding, yeah.
And this is tomorrow's the last night there, but like you said, it goes on Vimeo throughout the entire month.
Trending. How about that? I'm not a bit surprised. It's called Superstars Extended Version. Look for it, and I think you'll enjoy it. Ted, have a great Easter Sunday today, and again, thank you so much for joining us.
Dan, you're the best.
And if there was ever a song made for today, it would be this one. Such a beautiful day. Hope you're getting out to enjoy it. You know what I miss? You know, since we moved out of that old dump at Tribune Tower, that I don't know if a lot of people know is now the only mattress store in the Magnificent Mile. But what I used to enjoy on Easter Sunday in particular, you know, we would do the show right in the window on Michigan Avenue, the Showcase Studio, as we used to call it. People get all dressed up and stroll Michigan Avenue, and you see people, in their Easter finery, going to church, going to brunch. Back when people went to brunch, back in the old days when you could still go out and eat with people. But that was really nice on Easter Sunday morning. Do you remember that, Andy?
I do on occasion. Yeah, I would see it in the camera since I was
right
up a few floors from you at that point. But yeah, there was a lot of activity bustling on Michigan Avenue on Easter Sunday.
Easter Sunday morning was always a nice Sunday to be out on the street. You hardly even noticed all the spit and garbage that was out there. And we still don't know, by the way, as long as I'm talking about the old Tribune Tower, we still do not know the whereabouts of the Walk of Fame plaques.
True.
That were in Pioneer Court that were out there. I went by there a couple of weeks ago. I think I mentioned this on the show. I went by there. It was covered with, they had like plywood down on the sidewalk, presumably to protect our plaques that were down. And, now they're getting ready for the completion of the mattress store that's going to be opening there. I can't believe the number of people who actually believe me that there's really a mattress store there, when really it's like $10 million condos they're building. So the plywood's up, but the plaques are gone.
Maybe it was a preemptive measure by the folks here at WGN Radio to get those out of there before any mattress store patrons could step on them.
Destruction?
Yeah.
Like during the construction, I get it. Maybe they thought they were going to destroy it. Yeah. Heaven knows you don't want to destroy Dean Richards' Walk of Fame plaque. But they must be somewhere because they're not on the sidewalk anymore. They're no longer there. And then some people have said, well, maybe they're going to move them over here. To our new building at 303 East Wacker, but maybe they're just in an office someplace.
I don't know. We have the big WGN radio sign that used to be on that building,
right
as we get off the elevator.
Yeah, that used to be right. Yeah. That's in I guess what is essentially our lobby here. But I would like to know where the plaques went.
Maybe that's where Schwanee is today, looking into that.
I'll bet he's destroying my plaque. I'll bet he's doing something.
Probably change the name on it.
Scratched up.
Yeah.
Put Dope Richards on it. Scratch.
This guy.
Change my first name to Idiot. Something like that. Yeah, that's possible. It's very possible. So I'm going to try to spend a little bit of time talking about food for this half hour. We get ready to get into our food show. We had so much reaction this week to the ham that I made, Easter ham that I made in a slow cooker on TV. It's not the first time I've done it. I've done it several times now because it's been so popular every time that I've done it. And I think it's so popular, not because of any genius thing that I'm doing, is because it's so incredibly simple and turns out so incredibly delicious. It is it's a ham that you buy in the store. I buy a spiral cut shank ham with bone in it. I want it with the bone, because when, you know, when we're done eating the ham, I want to take the bone and make some nice split pea soup with it. That's my go-to thing every year with that. But you take the ham, you put it in the slow cooker. Now, what I do before I put the ham in the slow cooker, I lay some pieces of kitchen twine in the slow cooker and let it hang both sides out of the slow cooker, and then I put the ham on top of the strings. The reason that I do that is when it's done cooking, then it's so easy to get the ham out of the slow cooker, and you're not messing around with spatulas and, you know, burning your fingers trying to get this thing that's been in the slow cooker for 6 to 8 hours out. It just, you grab one end of the string, the other end of the string, you lift it right out. Couldn't be easier. But what goes into the slow cooker with the ham is some pineapple juice. If you can get fresh pineapple juice, great. If not, the kind that you get in your dairy case is fine. Even the canned pineapple juice. They sell pineapple juice that's not from concentrate. I would try to get it without, you know, if you can find some without concentrate, I would try to use that. But it's pineapple juice, it's maple syrup, and it's brown sugar. And it's about twice as much. I would say it's like a cup of maple syrup, a cup of brown sugar, and 2 cups of pineapple juice. Twice as much pineapple juice. It's really all that you put in there. Now, I put cloves. I happen to like the taste of cloves. Not everybody does. But I think it gives an Easter ham, or, you know, any kind of ham, a really nice taste. So you take the whole cloves and you just sort of poke them all over the ham. This mixture of the brown sugar, maple syrup, and pineapple juice, I mix that up ahead of time and really get it, you know, so it dissolves as much as it can. Then I pour it over the ham. I put the lid on the slow cooker and forget about it. For, you know, if you have it on a high setting on the slow cooker, I would say probably about 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours. If you have it on a low setting, you could probably go 6 to 7 hours. But it frees up your oven. It frees up, you know, some space with the other things that you may be preparing for Easter Sunday dinner. And it comes out so delicious. I think the pineapple juice, the enzymes in the pineapple juice help to make the ham extra tender. It certainly makes it super flavorful between the brown sugar, maple syrup, and the pineapple juice. It cuts the saltiness of the ham. It's not overly sweet. It's not through the roof sweet, but it just kind of neutralizes the, you know, sometimes it can have a really pork kind of taste, like super pork taste that can be a little overwhelming. The mixture seems to balance that out a little bit. And if you don't overcook it, the ham just comes out so tender and delicious, and is just another big hit this year. I've had a lot of people telling me that they've cooked it in the past and it's their only way to do it now. They really love it. I've had people telling me they're doing it today as we speak. They're slow cookers. Some people, you know, have been emailing and texting in questions to me about, you know, do I do this or do I do that? Somebody said, can I do the ham? Can I cook it on Saturday? You know, and then serve it on Sunday. It's like, well, you can, but there's no reason to. The ham really is, it's already cooked. It's not like you're, you know, physically cooking the ham. Really, you're just warming it up in these juices. So, you know, I said, just get all your things ready on Saturday. Get the cloves in there, get the mixtures ready, get everything ready to go. So all you have to do is put the ham in the slow cooker and turn it, you know, pour the juice in and turn it on and wait for 6 hours. So a lot of people told me they, you know, got up at 6, 7 o'clock this morning. They did all of that, and their ham should be, you know, coming out of the slow cooker any time now with all of the sides and, you know, things that might go along with that. So I hope that worked out. It's probably, you know, if you're only now getting this recipe, it's probably too late for you to serve today for Easter Sunday. But if you want to get that recipe, if you want to see the video, I did make it on television this past Wednesday. You can get all of my recipes. You can see all of my videos for my cooking segments at WGNTV.com/DeanCooks. We put everything up on my cooking site. And that way you can watch the videos for when things work and for things don't work. We do this live. We do the cooking segments live. It's not like every other TV chef where everything is edited and you never see any mistakes. What I do is on live television. So sometimes it works and occasionally we have little disasters. And, you know, that's actually kind of fun, too, when that happens. But anyway, so that's what I did with the ham. I would just really want to open the phone lines up for a kind of an Easter Sunday food open line. If you want to tell me if you do your ham a certain way, or if there's something that you serve that's traditional in your family, your ethnicity for Easter Sunday, would love to hear that. If you've got questions about preparing things, I'd be happy to answer your questions as best I can. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. I ran across a piece this morning that talked about the different traditional foods of different ethnicities. Things that, you know, for example, if you are Argentinian and celebrating Easter today, you are probably eating a torta pascualina. Torta pascualina, which is a savory pie with ricotta cheese, boiled eggs, spinach, artichoke, and parsley wrapped in phyllo dough, that very thin paper-like dough. And you bake that, and the phyllo dough turns, you know, beautifully crusty and delicious. You probably, you know, I've cooked with phyllo, and you just kind of brush it with butter. So it gets, you know, delicious and separates the leaves of the phyllo dough with this stuffing, this filling that is the ricotta, the hard-boiled eggs, the spinach, artichoke, and parsley. And apparently it is a very common dish for Argentinians to serve during for Easter that symbolizes the resurrection of Jesus. I never knew that before. I just learned that. If you are of Mexican descent, you may be having a capriotada. Capriotada, I'm guessing, is how you say that. It's a bread pudding that is similar to using baguettes, you know, old bread that you have laying around. You put that in and mix it with a syrup of sugar, cinnamon sticks, cloves, nuts, dried fruit, and sprinkles that go on top of it. And, you know, it's served like sort of like a dessert. And it represents, represents the resurrection. The cloves that are in it represents the nails that were used, during the crucifixion and, et cetera. So, I mean, it's all very symbolic. Finland has a dessert, a traditional dessert that is made from molasses, malted rye, rye flour, and orange zest. It looks to be sort of like a pudding. Looks really good. We have a lot of Polish people in Chicago. This says that white borscht is very common for celebrating Easter in Polish families. White borscht, made with soured rye flour, sausage, and hard-boiled eggs. I don't think I've had any of these things, but be very, very curious to find out. You know, if you have something special in your family, some kind of tradition, I would love to hear about that. Would love to answer your questions. I'd love to talk about food with you. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll be right back to do all of that when we come back.
Here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail. Hippity hopping, Easter's on its way.
We don't hear enough Gene Autry on the air.
Bring in every girl and boy.
A little Peter Cottontail action here this morning as we get into an Easter version of our Food Time show, Chicago Radio's award-winning all-edible program here today, answering your questions, helping you out with questions that you may have, international Easter dishes. I'm curious to hear about some of those. And you know what else I wanted to open up? I know a lot of you are going to have a lot of leftover hard-boiled eggs after today. What do you do with what's your favorite thing to do with them? Do you just eat them as a hard-boiled egg? Do you make egg salad? Do you find some other recipe? I ran into the best egg salad recipe of all time that I'll share with you in a minute. It's pesto egg salad. Pesto egg salad. Super delicious. Let me get to some phone calls, though. 312-981-7200. Steve, happy Easter to you. Good morning.
Hey, happy Easter, Dean. Good to talk to you. Hey, I don't know anything about cooking, but I'm motivated to make this recipe you're talking about. My question is a crock pot a slow cooker?
Yeah, same thing. Crock pot is just a brand name for a slow cooker. Slow cooker is just kind of a generic name. Black & Decker makes them, and they're perfectly fine. Instapot, the Instapots, which is a brand name for electric pressurized cooker. They now have them with settings on them, so you can use them as a pressure cooker. You can use them as a slow cooker. You can use them now as an air fryer. They have versions now that are air fryers as well.
Wow.
So
thank you very much.
Yeah. So any of those would work. The slow cookers or crock pot, they run, I would recommend getting anywhere between 6 and 8 quart capacity. You want one that's large enough, to handle most things that you're going to cook in it. They're between $30 and $50, something like that. They're not expensive. The Instapots, the pressurized cookers, especially the ones with the air fryers, are a little more expensive than that. But then you've got, it's more expensive, but you've got one unit that does several things. So, you can kind of multitask that way with that.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Gene. Appreciate it.
You bet. Good luck with that. Yeah, a bunch of people on our text line are asking, if I can repeat the recipe for my Easter ham. And I won't go over the whole thing again because, for the people who did hear it, I don't want to be repetitive. But we do have the recipe posted. It is, if you go to WGNTV.com/DeanCooks, the recipe is there. The video of me making it on the air is there. So you will be able to see it there. Here's a text that says, Dean, I never bought a ham before. Do you buy the ham shank in a can? The answer to that is no. Or do you get it from the fresh meat counter at the grocery store? The answer to that is yes. And how many pounds do you recommend? The poundage depends on the vessel that you're going to use to cook it. I have an 8-quart slow cooker at home, and I think I had an 8-pound shank. They sell them right in the store. The spiral cuts are what you want. What's in the can is that's kind of processed. They take ham pieces and form them to, fit into those cans. I grew up on those, and I don't remember them being awful in any way, but I just prefer one that, isn't processed like that. Betty, how about you? Whoops, wrong line. Here's Betty. You're on WGN.
Hi, Dean. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you, too.
I baked a ham this morning for brunch, and I didn't make it in the slow cooker. I made it in the oven, but the glaze I used was very much like yours, except for the pineapple juice. Instead of that, I used orange juice.
Oh, yeah, good.
But I had bought a bone-in butt portion ham, not a spiral slice. And I know that those are often very salty, and there are members in the family that are on salt-restricted diets.
Right.
So the tip that I had was I soaked the ham in my cooler with ice and water for 24 hours. And when we made it today, it was not salty tasting at all, and everybody really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, it worked. I did it with the corned beef, too, and that worked out really good. But with the corned beef, then, when I was boiling it, I changed out the water a few times, besides soaking it just for a couple of hours.
Yeah,
and I found that seemed to really work well. So I just wanted to pass that tip on.
That's fantastic to rinse the sodium, basically, out of the ham. You soaked it for 24 hours in ice water in an ice chest, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
yep.
And
yep.
With the corned beef, you did the same thing, the brisket, and then changed the water while you were cooking it. Now, when you cooked it in the oven, for how long did you leave it in there? You don't really need to leave it in there very long, right?
No. The recipe said that you should do it 10 minutes per pound at
375.
Okay.
And then after that, for 15 minutes, then you put that glaze on it, which, like yours, was the maple syrup, brown sugar, and then orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
You cooked it for 15 minutes. Then you put some glaze on it again for 15 minutes. Oh, and that was at 425. And then at the end, you just took it out. And if you had any glaze left, you kind of poured it over it, and you let it sit out of the oven for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Before cooking it.
Yeah.
And it was so yummy. Everybody loved it. Yeah.
That's a good idea. I should have mentioned to let it rest when you're done cooking. That's the only downside about my slow cooker method is, you know, you got that nice glaze kind of crunchy in the oven, didn't you, a little bit?
Yeah, which I love.
And the slow cooker doesn't get that way.
I love using the slow cooker, though, too. So I imagine that it was delicious.
But this was
a recipe I had upon, and it just gave me such a taste for ham, but I often don't make it because of the salt restrictions for some of the members. So I did that, and boy, it turned out great. Really good.
All right, let me ask you then, as long as you got a good tip for me on the ham, hard-boiled eggs. What do you do with your hard-boiled eggs when you have them left over for Easter?
Everybody loves deviled eggs, so I'll make those, and then we grab some of those for lunch. And then, of course, I make egg salad. Yeah, that's it. Or I'll egg, and I'll cut it into like a lettuce salad, you know, just to have it as the protein on a salad.
Yeah. I had that the other day, and it was very delicious. Tell me now your deviled eggs. Walk me through your recipe if you've got a second, because my mom used to make the best deviled eggs, and I never did get her recipe for it. So I'm going to have to do some experimenting to see if I can, replicate that.
Kind of a put together recipe. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm talking to you. This is so awesome. After listening every Sunday, I have the radio on in my kitchen.
Thank you for calling in after all these Sundays.
Oh, it's awesome. Anyway, so I just, you know, of course, cut them in half, scoop out the yolks, and then I put like not a lot of mayonnaise, like just a spoonful. Say if I have a dozen eggs, like a good spoonful of mayo, and I always put a little relish in it and a little mustard.
Right.
And then a little salt and pepper, and then I smoosh it up. And sometimes, depending on who in the family is going to be eating it, sometimes I even make a little bacon and then crumble a bit of that in it, too.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that's a nice touch. So that's pretty simple then, really.
Real simple. And I think you can adjust the flavors. I have a friend, when she makes it, she puts a little bit of horseradish in it.
I was going to say, I like it a little. I like a little bite to it.
Yeah, I do, too. I do, too. But even like a little Tabasco, a couple of dots of that in it is yummy. Or sprinkle on the top, then I sprinkle paprika, and I take a tiny bit of cayenne and put that on, too.
Yeah, I think my mom used to do that also, because hers, you definitely, your mouth was burning a little bit. In a good way. It wasn't overwhelming, but it's not what you were expecting from a deviled egg to have a little bite like that. But that's great. All right. Well, nice to talk to you. I'm glad you called in.
Thank you so much. And happy Easter to you next weekend then.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the Eastern Orthodox Easter, the Greek Easter this year is actually May 2nd. It's way late this year. So I'm gonna have to wait to get my, you know, we usually do leg of lamb. There is this Greek lasagna that I've talked about, pastizo, which is, you know, often served. Probably there's an Easter bread, that's very traditional to Greek families. But there is, you know, Greeks fast. They go meatless for 40 days for the Lenten period. So after a midnight service on the Saturday night that turns into Easter Sunday morning, they break the fast with a soup that is made out of this. This used to terrify us as kids. It's a soup made out of the innards of the lamb that would be served for dinner the next day. It's just all the disgusting parts of the soup. The soup was actually quite delicious if you didn't know what was in it. But that is the terrifying part of that tradition that, you know, kids were like, I don't want to eat intestines, whatever happened to be in it. Somebody texting in asking, can you make your ham recipe in an Instapot? The answer is yes. It's a lot faster. I don't know the exact measurement. I would have to look it up, but I know that it would be maybe 6 or 8 minutes per pound, as opposed to it being 4 hours. It might be 40 minutes in a Instapot because it's pressure cooking. So it's, yes, you can do it. But again, you need, most Instapots are a little on the small side. So you would need a larger one to accommodate that. Here is the 773 area code. Dean, happy Easter. I'm using your recipe in my crock pot. My ham shank was too big, even when I trimmed it. So I put it in the crock pot with heavy-duty foil around the top and then weighed it down with my cast-iron skillets. Wow, that is some innovative thinking there. I would have never thought to do that, but a good idea. This is Pete. You are on WGN. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you. Well, early for you,
yes,
Dean.
Yes.
One thing that we've always done is a dish that my mom called Eggs Goldenrod. Now, as far as I know, this is Eggs Benedict under a different guise, because I don't know what Eggs Benedict is. But what she would do is take the hard-boiled eggs, separate them, so you had the whites and the yolks, chop up the whites, mix them in with a white sauce, serve that over toast, and then grate the yolks on top.
Oh. That sounds very, very interesting. So a white sauce, like a bechamel sauce, something like that, or
not a sweet sauce, just a simple,
yeah, like, sort of a white gravy, sort of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And just the chopped up whites go into that, and then over some decent toast. I don't want to see any white bread.
like maybe a nice English muffin. So
you could use an English muffin.
English muffin or a nice...
some whole wheat.
Yeah, like a multi-grain, nice thick piece of
something,
multi-grain.
Something with some girth. Some body to it.
Right. Yeah, that sounds pretty good, and very similar to... Sorry, go ahead. We have a delay on the phone, but go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the only thing I was thinking is you do want to use a fine grater, because you want the yolks to come out in an almost powdery, fine, like a seasoning.
Yeah, if you put those over a grater, they should come out. You don't want them too chunky, basically.
No.
You want them
right.
kind of a fine grind. That's very similar to hollandaise. Or Eggs Benedict, which is traditionally, it's a toasted English muffin. It is a poached egg. You would take the egg and poach it, and then place the poached egg on top of the English muffin and top it with a hollandaise sauce, which is very slightly more spiced version of what you're talking about. So it's very, very similar, I think.
No, it's kind of, I don't know, kind of a left reverse English version, if you will.
Yeah, that sounds, actually, it sounds very, very good. The traditional Eggs Benedict doesn't answer the question, what do you do with leftover hard-boiled eggs? Which,
absolutely,
a lot of people are going to have tons of them left over tomorrow. So that's what I'm trying to find out. What do you do with your leftover hard-boiled eggs.
And after my brother and I got too old for the Easter Bunny to really come around and leave things for us, Mom still had to make up a bunch of hard-boiled eggs for Easter.
Of course.
We had to have that dish.
It's tradition. You got to have a basket full. Somebody mentioned to me yesterday, the kids today with the Easter eggs, if they're not filled with money or candy, the kids aren't interested.
Whatever happened to an egg being full of egg?
Full of egg. Exactly right. Exactly right. Pete, I hope you have a great day today. Thank you for calling in.
You too. Have a great one. And I can tell you from my own experience already, outdoors is glorious
today. I cannot wait to get outside and roll those windows down, open those windows, get a little fresh air. I can't wait for that. Peter, thank you, my friend. I appreciate your call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Okay, so I got to tell you, you know, I know a lot of you are going to make egg salad. That's a very traditional after Easter. And, you know, you make it up, you put a little celery in it, and the mayonnaise goes in it, and whatever else, you know, you put in. I would put chopped celery. If I was just going to make regular egg salad, I would put some chopped celery. I might put some, I like green onions. I like the taste of a scallion or green onion, so I would chop those up finely. I would put that in there. You know, you can put or chop up, but just chop it up finely. Red onion, if you've got Vidalias, nothing better than a Vidalia onion, in my opinion. But so the mayonnaise, maybe, you know, want to put a little mustard in it, salt and pepper, of course. But I found a recipe that also puts minced garlic in it, number one. Everything is better with garlic incorporated into it, everything, without question. And pesto sauce. You kidding me? I never would have thought of that in a million years. But I saw the recipe and I'm imagining what that would taste like. I can't wait to go try that now. It's, you know, traditional egg salad, and this recipe adds 4 teaspoons of pesto, prepared pesto, and 1 garlic clove. For civilians, I would put the 1 garlic clove. For people like me, I would put like 3. That's how much I love it. And I can't imagine how much nicer that would taste. Yes, on top of some nice toasted, I might use a nice multigrain bread. An English muffin, I guess, would be fine. I think I like the multigrain. I like the taste of the multigrain, and maybe put a little lettuce and, you know, tomato on top of it as well. 312-981-7200. Let me see what we've got going on in the old text line here. I know that we've got some recipes. Someone is saying, oh, don't forget the relish. Yeah, don't forget the relish in the egg salad. Relish, or as my mom used to say, pick-a-lily. Anyone else's mom ever called it that? Don't forget the pick-a-lily. It's relish. It was just, you know, green relish. Somebody else, 847 area code, puts dill and parsley in it and chopped blacked olives. Oh, that sounds good. 708 area code, my mother would slice the hard-boiled eggs and fry them in butter with leftover sliced Polish sausage. That sounds absolutely delicious. I love that. 847 area code, Dean, did your family dye the eggs red? I learned that that was a Greek tradition. I miss talking to your mom. She was a lovely lady. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate that. Yes, it is a Greek tradition. A deep red, you know, in traditional Greek families, you don't have the multicolored pastel eggs. You might cook a few for the kids, but the traditional is deep red, which is symbolic for the blood of Christ. That's why they do that. I know, not exactly the most appetizing thing to put. It's not actual blood you're putting on the egg. It's red, you know, dye. But that's the thinking behind that. It's traditional. It's symbolic of the blood of Christ. So if you're going to a Greek house, look for those deep red eggs. That's what they have. Let's get to Lee. You're on WGN. Happy Easter to you.
Hi, Dean.
Hello.
I just have a follow-up to your deviled egg recipes.
Sure.
I have one that's even more simpler than some of the ones that you've had on before.
Okay.
All you do is mash up the yolks, and instead of adding mayo and relish and mustard and this and that and the other, you just buy a little jar of sandwich spread.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's
that
got
has everything in it.
That's
it
got everything
mayo,
in it already.
It has some little flecks of pickles. It has a little bit of pimento.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, mix it up regularly and put it in the whites of your egg. And if you want, you can sprinkle paprika or cayenne or whatever your taste will allow.
Yeah.
And that's it. And my kids love it. And Grandma has to make that for any holiday,
sure.
Christmas, New Year's, Mother's Day, whenever.
Yeah, it's tradition. Wow, that is like so simple.
That's right.
I can't believe that everybody's.
And it doesn't make a big mess.
I was going to say, I can't. It's like right in front of our face, and we didn't think of it.
I've been doing it for years. When I was a kid, I had white bread with sandwich spread,
that
was a real treat.
That's right.
Where I got hooked on the sandwich spread.
Got a nice sandwich spread sandwich there. Exactly right.
There you go.
Lee, I hope you have a wonderful Easter today, and I thank you so much for that brilliant idea. Thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome, and happy Easter to you whenever it is, May.
May 2nd is when I'll be indulging. Thank you for the call. That's a great idea. 815 area code says, put a little mashed avocado in the deviled eggs. Yum! That sounds good. 847, tuna fish with the eggs. I'm going to pass on that, I think. Tuna fish in my egg salad? Nope. I'll pass. Peppercini in the egg salad. That sounds good. That'll give you a nice, that gives you a little crunch and a little bite. 847, hey, Dean, I always put basil in my egg salad. That sounds quite delicious also. Love that. I put it in my egg salad and my chicken salad. Yeah, some great ideas there. All right, we'll post some of these up for you if you want to do some follow-up. And we'll take a quick break and get ready for some news next on WGN.
WGN.